of the Navy for Energy.
WWFD
Frederick. WWTFM HD2 Manassas. WTOPFM HD2 Washington. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In 2009, approximately 14% or 17 million households were food insecure. At the same time, we face an obesity epidemic among not only adults but children as well. As unbelievable as it may seem, obesity and hunger do coexist. How does the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service work to address these problems? What federal programs seek to reduce hunger while promoting better nutrition? Are there new and innovative approaches to reducing hunger and improving nutrition? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Julie Parity, Administrator of the Food and Nutrition Service within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Randy Livingston. Randy, welcome.
Thank you.
Julie, I'd like to start off by learning more about USDA's Food and Nutrition Service. Would you give us an overview of the history, mission, and evolution of the FNS?
The Food and Nutrition Service is my very favorite agency. I say it's the greatest agency in the federal government. My staff hears me talk about it all the time. Its mission is just so noble: to increase food security among the American public and reduce hunger. We do it in partnership with cooperating organizations. We provide children and low-income people access to food, to a healthful diet and nutrition education. And we do it in a manner that supports American agriculture and that inspires public confidence. That's our goal. Our primary responsibility at the Food and Nutrition Service is to oversee the administration of the nation's 15 nutrition assistance programs. And these programs touch the lives of one in four over the course of a year. So our mission is very important, very critical to the food security of our nation. And they're at the forefront of ending hunger and improving the nutrition and health of low-income kids and families all across the country.
So with an important mission like that, could you give us a sense of the scale of operation of your agency? How is it organized, the size of its budget, the number of employees?
Well, we are organized. We've got a headquarters that is here in the metropolitan area. Our headquarters staff is about 500 people. We have a total of 1,300 people that work at FNS. About 800 of those people work in seven regional offices around the country and in a number of field offices and satellite offices as well. We are part of the mission area at the Department of Agriculture called the Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Service. We have a sister agency that's really quite small, about 35 people, I believe, called the Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion, which is also part of that mission area of USDA. And the Center on Nutrition Policy and Promotion really is that agency of government that tries to link science research to consumers, present it in a way that consumers can understand. And one of the big things they do is the dietary guidelines. So the dietary guidelines for Americans are due to be released, the next set, in very early 2011, and we work hand-in-hand in all of our nutrition messages with our sister agency, the Center on Nutrition Promotion and Policy. In FY 2010, believe it or not, the federal government spent over $90 billion to fund the 15 nutrition assistance programs. That represents more than 60% of the total USDA expenditures. And, of course, FNS is overseen by me, by the Office of the Administrator, and then run throughout our program by the regions and policies made at headquarters.
So with an important mission and such a large budget or investment, what are your larger responsibility and what's your role leading this agency? Could you tell us about those responsibilities?
Well, you know, when I was blessed and honored to be chosen to be the administrator in the Obama administration of the Food and Nutrition Service, one of the reasons I was thrilled was because the president had made such a historic commitment to ending childhood hunger. And I thought, we're going to have great policymakers from the president right on down. Secretary Vilsack, I knew, was very engaged and interested in all of the work of FNS. We've got a brilliant undersecretary in Kevin Concannon and a great political team. So I thought, you know, they don't need another policymaker sort of in the mix. And I realized that my mission really was to be the administrator of the Food and Nutrition Service and do everything that I possibly can to support the quite amazing staff that we have at FNS. One of the things that I've learned is that, you know, originally, probably going back to 1980, FNS had about 2,800 people. We now have about 1,300. In the early days of our agency, we were all about combating hunger. Over time, we have added to that mission the important mandate to improve the nutritional quality of the meals that we serve in school meals and the nutrition messages. So, and of course, the benefits have gone up from 13, 14, 15 million people in the food stamp program. Now we've got about going on 43 million people in our food stamp program, what we now call SNAP. We've gone from maybe $15 billion to approaching $100 billion. So one of the real challenges for me as administrator is finding a way for this agency to bear this tremendously increased load and this heavy load with less than half the people that we used to have in the old days. So that's my mission. I figure if I can support the staff, make sure that they are happy every single day when they come into work, that that's the best way I can serve the American people through these wonderful programs. So I've done a number of things. I've actually strengthened the relationship between management and the union because the union really represents all of that staff. And another thing we've done that I'm really excited about is some months ago we launched a program called Great for Eight. And sort of the premise of Great for Eight is that I need every single one of those amazing people, all 1,300 of them, to come into work each and every day and be great. We cannot afford for them to be distracted by any kinds of issues that can get in the way of them being happy and productive every single day. And I know a happy worker is going to be a productive worker. And I think the stresses at the agency that have been imposed over time had really caused us to lose sight of the fact that our people really do need to be very well supported. And rather than presuming that we might know at the senior levels what would make staff more productive and happier, I've asked them. We set up on our intranet site, we set up a suggestion box, and we found other ways for them to meet each other and get together and come forward with ideas. We ended up with about 350 suggestions. We had a great committee come together that evaluated all of those suggestions and put them into the various buckets. And in September, we launched our Great for Eight, and we're doing a number of things. We're doing something called Out and About, where folks can leave the office and go out for a few hours and maybe visit a WIC clinic, maybe go see kids eating a school lunch, maybe go to a SNAP office, a food stamp office, so that they can really get a very good sense of what our programs are all about. We established an art committee. And so we've got art from the staff all around the building on the walls, and that's very exciting. We've got a number of things that are happening as a result for Great for Eight. And it's part of Secretary Vilsack's cultural transformation. He takes this all very seriously. Great for Eight is our way of supporting the Secretary's initiative as well.
Julie, regarding your responsibilities and duties, what are the top three challenges you face in your position, and how have you addressed those challenges?
Well, the Secretary has a number of priorities, and we are very much involved in two of those. He wants to make sure that America's children and the world's children have access to safe, nutritious, and balanced meals. And, of course, that goes to the core of what the Food and Nutrition Service is all about. And he wants to make sure that rural communities create wealth so that they're self-sustaining and repopulating and thriving economically. The two pieces, of course, ending childhood hunger by 2015, which the president has told us is his one of his top priorities, and then the First Lady has an initiative to end childhood obesity within a generation, have us all extraordinarily busy It is a huge task just to run our 15 nutrition assistance programs. And with the new challenges that have come with this administration, we are truly scrambling. And so one of the real challenges, of course, is to try to find the right balance between the new initiatives and just making sure that our programs are being run effectively and efficiently. And then I think the other thing that is really difficult is the budget constraints. You know, we all know what 2011 is going to bring with a long-term continuing resolution. Prospects for 2012 don't look much better. And so at a time when I'm trying to get more done with fewer people than ever before, trying to find ways to squeeze efficiencies out of our processes is a very great challenge. Those are things that keep us very busy. With respect to the rural communities creating wealth, I don't think probably most people stop to realize that our programs really do pour funds and money into economies. For example, in our SNAP program, formerly the food stamp program, what we now call SNAP, for every additional expenditure of $5 of SNAP benefits, that pours $9.20 into the local economies. And you can see why, because it's spent at a grocery store. So the grocer profits, and certainly the distributors and the wholesalers and the food manufacturers and, you know, the people who transport that and ultimately the farmers. So we feel that we're ideally placed at agriculture and that we have a great impact on the economy as well. And that supports a very important initiative of the Department of Agriculture. The next 4 years are going to be really important for us at FNS. We're going to be very, very busy. The Congress passed and the President signed the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Bill. It's a historic piece of legislation. It's going to take a great deal of work on the part of staff to implement that. And implementation of the 2010 Dietary Guidelines is going to mean that we're going to have to take another look at all of our nutrition messages and all the work that we do in the area of nutrition education to make sure that it's consistent with the government's guidelines in terms of nutrition. So we're very excited about what's being put on our plate, and it just underscores the importance of our programs.
I understand you've worked for more than three decades to improve national food and nutrition programs. Would you describe your career path for our listeners? And how did you begin your career and what brought you to your current leadership role?
I actually came to Washington back in late 1979, having just graduated from law school. I went to law school late. I had got married and had two children. My first position was as a staff attorney in the general counsel's office at the Department of Agriculture. And I actually worked in the division that supported the Food and Nutrition Service. So that's how I got my start here, and I worked in the general counsel's office for just about 10 years. And then I went, had the wonderful opportunity to go work on Capitol Hill. And I worked at the House Agriculture Committee as a subcommittee consultant. I worked with a number of wonderful, fine members of Congress. I worked with Kika de la Garza when he was chair of the House Agriculture Committee. I worked with Charlie Stenholm on a number of ag issues. And in spite of the fact that my background really was the food stamp program, I had the great opportunity to get to know ag policy and work with a number of ag programs. Then in 1997, I was chosen to be the Deputy Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services back at the Department of Agriculture. And so I had the privilege of being a political appointee in the Clinton administration for the final 3 years of that administration. Interestingly enough, at that point, at the end of the Clinton administration, I was able to retire. And so I did. I retired from government service and about 6 months later went to work in the nonprofit community. I worked for an organization called America's Second Harvest, which is the nation's food bank network. They're currently called Feeding America. And they had a very active public policy and advocacy shop in Chicago at their headquarters, and they realized they ought to have a presence in Washington. So they asked me if I would open a D.C. office for them, which I was happy to do. I worked for them for about 5 years, and then I retired again. I was very happily retired so I could be a full-time wife. My children by that time had presented me with grandchildren, so I had a wonderful time playing with my three grandchildren and being there for them. And I thought I was done. And then Barack Obama was elected president. And I had to sort of give some serious thought to coming back into federal service. I had for many, many years thought the best job in Washington would be administrator of the Food and Nutrition Service. I have such huge respect and admiration for the people at FNS and for the programs. And I thought being there, working with them day in and day out, would be such an honor and such a thrill. So I was so pleased to be chosen as administrator for the Food and Nutrition Service. So in May of 2009, I started my current position. And indeed, it has been everything I had hoped for and more. I am delighted to be the administrator of this great agency. It's such a privilege and such an honor.
Given your wealth of experience, what are the characteristics that make up an effective leader? And more importantly, who along your career has influenced your leadership and management approach?
Well, you know, it's interesting because until I became administrator, I really had always sort of considered myself kind of a staff person. I had done staff work largely, policy work certainly, but didn't consider myself an administrator or a manager, or quite frankly, hadn't considered myself a leader in sort of the commonplace sense of that. But I have found that I have thoroughly enjoyed the administrative part and the management part of being the administrator. And the kinds of things I've realized that I didn't know would help me, that have helped me, have been very interesting to me as I've thought about it. I am seen as someone who is empathetic. I walk in the shoes of people. I listen to people. I try very hard to understand where people are coming from. I think I got that from my mom. My mom was always good about that. I remember when I was a kid and I would come home and complain about something that my teacher had done or that she had yelled at us or, you know, given someone a hard time in class. And it was always a little disturbing to me because we didn't come from the kind of family that did that. And my mom would always say, "Oh my goodness, sounds like your teacher must have just had a bad day." And I think that so often that you just sort of need to get into the heads of other people and sort of understand what might be going on with them if you want to really be able to effectively work for them. I think it helps that I'm not thin-skinned. I've got a pretty good sense of self. And so I can work with all kinds of people, and I don't think I take things personally. I think that helps if you're going to try to lead people, that you've got a good, strong sense of self. My dad taught me that it is important to do the right thing, to make a real commitment to doing things properly, doing things well, doing things right. And so I try hard not to play games and to really think through what is the right thing to do in any given situation and somehow find a way to do that. I've learned some things from the people that I've worked with over the years. I know Charlie Stenholm, when he was in the Congress and I was supporting him, was always one of the most optimistic and positive people as he would move forward, and taught me a great deal about inclusion, that you don't just work with your friends, that you've got to reach out to the folks who challenge you and who have a different view of things. The undersecretary that I worked for when I was in the Clinton administration, a wonderful woman, Shirley Watkins, taught me the benefit of perseverance. She would frequently say, "Julie, we're going to try this, and if we can't get in the front door on this one, we'll go in the back door. We'll see if we can find a window open, or we'll go in through the basement door. But, you know, we're going to persevere, and we're going to find a way to make this policy difference." And so I am not easily discouraged. I am optimistic, and I am ever so grateful for the people that I've learned from over the course of my career.
How does the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, work? We will ask Julie Parity, Administrator of the Food and Nutrition Service within the U.S. Department of Agriculture, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has chronicled stories of large, complex organizational transformations, but it is also important to tell the stories of frontline leaders making a difference on a smaller scale. Pick up Transforming State Government Services Through Process Improvement, a case study of Louisiana by Dr. Vicki Grant, and find out more. This report is a first-hand story of using common sense management to improve and redesign a vital element of human service delivery. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Julie Parity, Administrator of the Food and Nutrition Service within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Also joining us today from IBM is Randy Livingston. Julie, your agency administers 15 nutrition assistance programs. Would you specifically outline the role that states play in delivering these programs and how they work with your agency to manage and distribute the benefits?
We couldn't do it without our state partners. We've got 1,300 people at the Food Nutrition Service. We have $100 billion on most of benefits to get out. And thankfully, the way that it all happens is that every state has state agencies that are actually the administering agencies for us with respect to our programs. And those state agencies then work with folks at the local level. For example, in our SNAP program, formerly the food stamp program, what we call welfare offices are the offices with the state-paid caseworkers who actually take the applications from SNAP applicants and make the eligibility determinations and then work with those recipients to get the SNAP benefits that they can then use at their grocery store. With respect to our school meals programs, there's a state agency that's responsible for making sure that all of those school cafeterias are getting the funding that they need to be able to put together nutritious meals and serve those kids. We have a program called the Child and Adult Care Feeding Program, which provides reimbursement, federal reimbursement, for meals that are served in daycare centers and child care centers, family daycare centers that serve low-income children. So I think of our staff at the top of a pyramid, a grand pyramid, of probably hundreds of thousands of people that are ultimately responsible for distributing our benefits. It's an enormous task. Our regions are the ones that actually do the hand-to-hand work with our state agencies, the folks in headquarters doing more of the policy work. So it's a fine-tuned machine that at the end of the day serves one in four Americans and serves them very well.
Julie, you've mentioned a couple of times in our conversation the SNAP program or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Would you tell us a little bit more about this program and what are some of the critical challenges facing you and how are you addressing them?
This program goes back, incidentally, a very long way. It was authorized in 1961, but it actually goes all the way back to the 30s. It was a Depression-era program that actually did provide stamps to low-income households that they could take to a grocery store and exchange for food. And it has come from those earliest days to be a program now that serves almost 43 million people. In the last 36 months, we have seen an absolutely amazing increase in participation in this program, largely as a result, of course, of the economic downturn. We've had 23 consecutive months of historic highs. And so what it really does prove is that this program is doing exactly what it's intended to do. It's counter-cyclical. And so as the economy is challenged and more people are struggling to get from day to day to feed their families, this program is there for them. It's a mandatory entitlement. We don't have to worry about going to Congress to get more funds for this program. People who are eligible can participate. And then we have seen it. We've charted it over the course of its history. As the economy gets better, the SNAP participation reduces. We are very much looking forward to the day when that will happen. So it's a great program. It's the fundamental primary sort of safety net program that we have. I think very interestingly, we call it also our largest child nutrition program because 50% of the people in SNAP are kids.
Julie, due to those comments about the economic downturn, can you tell us how the states have been dealing with these higher applications and increasing caseloads while facing these significant budget reductions?
You know, you're absolutely right. It is a huge challenge. State coffers are really challenged to be able to provide all of the kinds of services that they traditionally have provided. So we are working very hard with states to help them find more efficient ways of doing things, more effective ways of doing things. We truly do understand the workload management challenges that are faced by states and local jurisdictions today. We are trying very hard to provide some administrative relief and sort of take a little bit of the burden off of the caseworkers, for example, because their caseloads have just grown so very dramatically. We are anxious to approve waivers to make this program easier for people to apply. If it's easier for people to apply, if it's easier for the application, if the application process can be streamlined, it's not only better for the applicant, but it also helps staff. And so we are all about trying to streamline policy and provide waivers to states so that they can provide a better service. We provide technical assistance to them. Our regional offices have developed wonderful relationships with the folks at the states. And so they work hand in glove to provide technical assistance to the states. And we also have something that's kind of unique, something we call state exchange funds, which is we have a small pot of money that where we can actually share some funds with states so that they can go to other states. For example, if a state is really challenged and knows that a neighboring state or another state is doing a particularly good job in one way or another, we can actually fund those state personnel to go to a model state. We can fund a model state to go to a state that is challenged. And these state exchange funds have made a great deal of difference. One of the things that is really wonderful about this program is that the states really do know each other. They really do learn from each other. And it has made an enormous difference over the course of the history of this program. Finally, we really are working increasingly with states on business process reengineering. There are some states that do an extraordinary job in terms of meeting this population with decreased staff, and they're doing it with great accuracy, which is another one of our challenges, is to make sure that the federal taxpayer dollars that go into SNAP are being properly and well spent. There are other states that don't do that so well. So we are learning from the states that have instituted really very effective business process reengineering and trying to share those processes with the other states. So we've got a lot going on in SNAP. You know, it's always the silver lining when you go through these kinds of challenges. I think when we get on the other side of this downturn in the economy, this program will be stronger and more efficient than it's ever been before.
Would you tell us about the special supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children, better known as the WIC program? And how are you working with states in that regard to enhance benefits delivery?
Well, WIC is probably our most popular program, certainly I know on the Hill. This is a program that provides nutritious foods. Also, there's a nutrition education component, breastfeeding promotion and support, and referrals to health and other social services to low-income women who are pregnant, postpartum, breastfeeding their babies, and kids up to age 5 who are at nutritional risk. Something that I learned just when I came on board with the Obama administration that I hadn't realized before is that just under 50%, almost 50% of the babies born in this country are born to WIC moms. So it's a very, very, very important program in terms of providing nutritional benefits to improve the health of those moms and babies. The WIC program, of course, is administered through grants awarded to state health departments or state agencies comparable to the health department. And then they are distributed, the people who participate in WIC are given vouchers, a series of vouchers each month that they can take to an authorized grocery store to purchase certain food items. And we've recently been able to enhance the traditional program by giving them vouchers that can be used specifically for fruits and vegetables. It's very, very popular. It's really making a difference. One of the things we found, kind of incidentally, since we've started the cash value fruit and vegetable program, is that in some communities that are served only by, this happens often in large cities, where you have only very small grocery stores with limited supply of items for food purchase, that because of this program now, where they can come in with a cash value, even those stores that are not participating in WIC, that are competing with the stores in WIC, are now starting to stock more fruits and vegetables. Well, who would have expected that? It certainly was not part of what was intended by this program, but it's having that kind of an impact. And we are starting to move now in working with states so that rather than using these paper vouchers or a system like that, they're going to be increasingly using a debit card, which is much like we use in the SNAP program now. We call it electronic benefits transfer, an EBT card. And the WIC moms will actually have a card that they can take to the grocery store to be able to get their WIC benefits. So that's all very, very exciting.
So, Julie, what about the child nutrition programs? Could you delve into those a little bit? And more particularly, what are you doing to improve program access, the standard of nutritional food, and exploring new strategies for reducing hunger and improving food choices for children?
Well, I'm so glad you asked, because we are very, very excited that the Congress has recently passed a major piece of legislation, the Child Nutrition Reauthorization. It's called the Healthy, Hunger-Free Kids Act. It will allow us for the first time in over 30 years to make real reforms to the school lunch and breakfast programs by really improving the critical nutrition and hunger safety net for millions and millions of kids. This act includes a number of provisions that are really quite historic. The president put money in the budget, and for the first time in many, many, many years, we've got additional funding for this program. We're going to be able to actually upgrade the nutritional standards for school meals. And what's going to really help us to do that is we're going to have additional federal funds to reimburse the schools. We're going to increase the reimbursement rate for school lunches by 6 cents for districts who comply with federal nutrition standards. Now, I know that doesn't sound like a lot, 6 cents per meal. But if you talk to the folks who prepare these foods, they're very, very excited about that 6 cent increase. It's the first reimbursement rate increase that we've had in this program for over 30 years. So we're very excited about that. We're also, for the first time, the Secretary of Agriculture has been given the authority to improve the nutritional quality of virtually all the foods sold in schools. We will be able to set nutritional standards for foods that are in vending machines, foods that are in the a la carte lines and the school lunch, the food that is sold in school stores. And so not just sort of the traditional school lunch that is available for kids, but the other kinds of foods that are going to that are sold in schools are now going to be required to meet nutritional standards. We're going to be able to increase the number of eligible kids enrolled in the school meal programs by using Medicaid data to directly certify kids. If they're getting Medicaid, if they're eligible for Medicaid and signed up for Medicaid, we're going to be able to directly certify them to get school meals so that they won't have to fill out additional applications. We're also going to find ways to eliminate the paper applications in communities that have high levels of poverty, and that will increase the opportunities for kids to get the free and reduced price meals. So there are a number of things in the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Bill that we are so excited about. We actually have over 100,000 schools that participate, and this is going to provide them additional incentive and opportunity. Let me just say, though, that even without these improvements in the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Bill, we know that there are many, 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 I dare say thousands of schools that are working very hard to make sure that the kids are getting really high-quality meals. We have a program called the Healthier U.S. School Challenge, which actually sets out a number of very difficult criteria in terms of nutrition education, physical activity, what is being served in schools, are they getting, fruits and vegetables, whole grains, low-fat dairy. And if they meet these criteria, they get an award. The highest award is gold with distinction. Then we have gold, silver, and bronze. And the First Lady has challenged us to double the number of schools who are getting the Healthier U.S. School Challenge. So it's just another example of this administration's commitment to making sure that kids are not only eating, but that they're eating well.
How is the Food and Nutrition Service working to reduce hunger while promoting better nutrition? We will ask its administrator, Julie Parody, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? How are disruptive innovations saving lives on the battlefield and expanding our presence in space? What is the U.S. Navy doing to strengthen its information dominance for the 21st century? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? And how are federal agencies leveraging technology to improve mission effectiveness? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. The Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine provides insights from those who lead. Hear from Richard Spires, leading Homeland Security's technology effort, Dr. Bobby Braun, advancing NASA's space technology program, Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, strengthening the U.S. Navy's information dominance, and Sam Polcrano, coordinating U.S. Postal Service sustainability efforts. All of this and so much more in the Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Julie Parody, Administrator of the Food and Nutrition Service within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Also joining us today from IBM is Randy Livingston. Julie, in 2009, I understand that approximately 14% or 17 million households were food insecure. At the same time, we face an obesity epidemic among not only adults, but children as well. As unbelievable as it may seem, obesity and hunger do coexist. Would you explain this seemingly paradoxical reality, and what are the causes that have led to this situation?
Well, there's a lot that we still have to learn about that, but a number of studies have suggested a possible correlation between food insecurity and obesity. It may be because nutrient-poor foods, energy-dense foods, cost less. And so that sort of promotes an overconsumption of calories leading to weight gain. To maintain adequate energy intake, people who have to limit their food costs may select lower quality diets consisting of high energy and inexpensive foods. People eat fewer fruits and vegetables, we know, as food insecurity worsens. One of the interesting things that we've been talking about recently is there's increasing interest in developing materials and messages showing that fruits and vegetables need not be more expensive. There's so much interest in eating well and eating more fruits and vegetables. And I think the general assumption is that typically fruits and vegetables are more expensive and so more out of reach of low-income households. But if you shop carefully and you know what you're looking for, that's not necessarily the case. You really can feed your family well on a tight budget. But I don't think we've done a very good job of explaining that to people and giving people the tips and the clues that they need to be able to make that work. So that's going to be something that we need to look at as we move forward. It has been a concern for us in the SNAP program for many years. I remember when I was part of the Clinton administration, we actually did develop a small recipe booklet that could be distributed to households when they applied for the food stamp program that would show them how they can use low-cost but nutritious meals to provide food and a nutritious meal for their family. So this is something that is of great interest to us. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I don't think that there's any question but what these two can be related. And I think it is a myth, for example, to suggest that people who are poor and overweight don't need help and don't need a food benefit, that they don't need the SNAP program. It's not because they're overeating. It's not because they have more money than they, you know, than they need to eat properly, but it's a function of the types of foods that are most easily accessible to them. You know, the other thing is we have been recently talking about this term food deserts. And we know that in many communities, there is not easy access to a grocery store that has a wide range of foods. And so often people in low-income communities are restricted to going to a retailer that may not offer the most nutritious foods or wide range of nutritious foods. And it is something that we call a food desert. And so we're working with the Department of Treasury, with other sister agencies at USDA on something called the Healthier Food Financing Initiative to be able to provide grants to get at this issue of food deserts. So it's a complicated issue. I think it's one that's been oversimplified over time. It's one we're very concerned about, and I think we still have a lot more to learn about it.
Julie, with over a $90 billion budget, it's critical, clearly critical, for FNS to be a strong fiscal steward of the public trust. This requires ensuring payments are correct and those who are eligible for the benefits receive the proper amounts. Would you elaborate on your efforts to eliminate improper payments and work with states to improve overall program performance and integrity, as well as how technology factors into your efforts?
Well, we have been about this for a very, very long time. I think we have really quite an extraordinary record in this regard. One of the problems, of course, is that the improper payments in our programs, our biggest programs, of course, SNAP and the School Meals Program, because they reach so many people, we reach 32 million people for kids, for example, in the School Meals Program. I mentioned we reach almost 43 million people with the SNAP program. So even if our errors are proportionally very, very small, they still add up to big numbers. And so we continue to be a primary focus when it comes to making sure that taxpayer dollars are spent properly and wisely. We take it very, very, very seriously. In SNAP, we have had from the inception of the program a very robust quality control system that measures errors that are made by either applicants to the program or by the caseworkers in the states that are administering the program. We provide performance bonuses to states. I mean, in the old days, we used to just have sanctions, and then we realized that it would be helpful to have a carrot as well. And so the Congress has authorized us to provide on an annual basis performance bonuses to states with the best and the most improved payment accuracy. And these are in the millions of dollars, and states vie for these performance bonuses. We do still have a system that could impose penalties on states with the poorest payment accuracy performance. And every year we've got some states we have to work with that need to improve their performance. We've put together something called the National Payment Accuracy Work Group. It's a team of experts from our agency, both the national and regional offices, to monitor and evaluate the progress in payment accuracy in SNAP and exchange information on best practices with the states. And we talk about technology with them and how we might be able to help them get more efficient in terms of their business processes. We have an early detection system based on preliminary quality control data so that we can quickly get in. If it looks like a state's going to have, you know, problems, we can get in before the year is out and see if we can help them correct those so that they won't be in a sanction mode. So we have actually gotten to be very, very skillful in terms of trying to find those errors that are made in our programs.
So, Julie, how do your programs and resources support the nation's emergency feeding networks, such as food banks and soup kitchens? More particularly, what is being done to improve and expand their capacity?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, particularly given that I had 5 years working at America's Second Harvest, now called Feeding America, the nation's food bank network. It's a series of about 200 food banks around the country. As you probably know, they get food not only from USDA, but they also get private donations and private funding, and we give them some administrative funding as well. The USDA part of that is something called the Emergency Food Assistance Program, something we affectionately call TFAP, and that's a statutory program that provides some funding for us to buy foods and also provides funding that we can help the food bank community meet their administrative costs. Funds actually go out through the states and the commodities, but most state distributing agencies now use the food bank community to distribute those funds. One of the wonderful things about the food bank community is that they really do understand their role in the nutrition safety net. They understand that school meals and SNAP are the primary pieces of this nutrition safety net, the other domestic nutrition assistance feeding programs, WIC, and that their role really is to sort of fill in the gaps wherever that safety net is a little bit frayed. They can be there to help families out. And so because they have come to realize their role, they are terrific and powerful and compelling advocates for our programs. And I know when I worked in the Congress, members were always so impressed when they would be visited by a food stamp director saying, "We need to make the food stamp program stronger because my food bank cannot take care of all of the folks in your district that have a problem and are having trouble putting food on their family table." And I've been doing this work for 30 years, and it's really been quite amazing to see how this nutrition community has grown, has evolved, has gotten much more sophisticated and much more powerful. And I think largely because of the commitment of this food bank network to all of our programs. And I really think it's one of the reasons that our programs enjoy the popularity that they do across the nation and in the Congress. And it hasn't always been so. Our connection with the food bank community is strong. It's compelling. And we couldn't do our work without them.
The 2008 Farm Bill authorized $20 million to research whether incentives for participants in the SNAP program will increase their purchase of healthy foods. Would you tell us more about the Healthy Incentives Pilot, HIP? How do you intend to evaluate its success, and in what practical ways does the HIP pilot represent an innovative approach to getting Americans to eat better?
This is an incentives-based program. What it's going to actually do is we're going to enroll about 7,500 randomly selected SNAP households to receive these incentives. For every dollar that a participant spends on fruits and vegetables using their SNAP EBT card, their debit card, 30 cents will be added to their benefit balance, thus cutting the cost of fruits and vegetables by almost one-third. So this should provide an additional incentive for them to purchase fruits and vegetables. And we are very, very excited to see what we'll learn from this project. We've got a very robust evaluation planned. It is not cheap. We're going to spend $20 million to see if this can really make a difference in terms of changing the purchasing habits of people who are participating in SNAP.
Your FNS programs are designed to provide access to healthy food and also build the skills and motivation to support and encourage healthy lifestyles. Would you elaborate on other efforts in health promotion, education, and economic development? And what are some of the key ways FNS is making nutrition education more effective?
Yeah, nutrition education is so important. It's fundamental to all of our programs. I think one of the reasons that the programs enjoy the support they do is because all of them have some nutrition education component to them. So we really do care not just making sure that people are eating, but that they are eating well. I just came, before this broadcast from a meeting of nutrition education experts in the area of our SNAP program. We're reevaluating how we're doing what we call SNAP Ed. SNAP Ed is SNAP Nutrition Education. And we're reevaluating how we're doing that and want to make sure that it's as robust as it possibly can be. We're learning so much in terms of nutrition education and what is effective nutrition education. We are pushed on a regular basis by OMB, by people on the Hill, particularly at this time of really tight budgets, to make sure that all of the nutrition education dollars that are being spent by USDA are being spent wisely. So we're being asked questions about which of the programs that you do are most effective, which are not. And that data is very, very hard to come by, particularly if what you care about is changing actually the consumption patterns of people. We don't want to measure these just by how many classes have we held or how many brochures have we passed out. What we really want to know is, are those people, are those households actually eating better, eating more nutritious food as a result of our nutrition education interventions? And that kind of data is very, very difficult to come by, but it's increasingly necessary, and I think the nutrition education community really does understand the importance of it. So this is an ongoing concern of ours. It's an ongoing effort. I think we still have a lot to learn, but the potential is absolutely enormous.
Judy, I was impressed as I was preparing for this conversation about the role your agency plays in emergency response. Perhaps you can elaborate on some of the benefits or services you provide during a disaster relief, and how do you do it?
You know, we've learned a lot over the years. We actually do have a program we call DSNAP. It's our disaster SNAP program. And in communities that have been struck by a devastating flood or a devastating hurricane, it certainly came into play, for example, in Katrina. You may remember the earthquake in Northern California some numbers of years ago, the floods through North Carolina back in the early days of 1999-2000. So we have really developed a program for SNAP. And so if you are a SNAP household that's lost all your food, you can get replacement benefits under DSNAP. If you're a low-income family that maybe wasn't participating in SNAP, you lost all your food, you can get DSNAP benefits. And these are benefits that are give you the opportunity to go to a grocery store and replace the food that was lost as a result of the disaster. We also, of course, have got USDA foods, what we formerly used to call commodities. We're now calling it USDA foods. And those are available to state and local and voluntary organizations for shelters and other mass feeding sites, or sometimes in food packages that are distributed directly to households in need. You may remember during Katrina, you would see those tables that would be set up with food for people. That is largely USDA foods. We can actually move foods out of school warehouses in time of a disaster and use them so that we can get food on the ground very quickly, and then we can later come in and replace those foods that might be in school warehouses. So we've got a pretty sophisticated way of meeting the food needs of people following a disaster.
What does the future hold for the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service? We will ask its administrator, Julie Parity, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Faced with seemingly intractable issues such as an ever-growing federal deficit, economic uncertainty, unemployment, and an aging infrastructure, it appears that the old adage, doing more with less, has taken on a whole new reality. Addressing the challenges arising from this new reality, brings with it opportunities to try different approaches and borrow new strategies. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine, we bring together leaders, innovators, practitioners, and thinkers who offer models to follow, provide insights that can infuse theory to practice, and pave the way to reshaping the business of government. Hear from Dr. Bobby Braun, chief technologist at NASA, about advancing its space technology program. Air Force Surgeon General Bruce Green on how disruptive innovations are saving lives on the battlefield. Dr. David McClure of GSA on how the federal government's trying to become more open, collaborative, and innovative. Richard Spires leading Homeland Security's technology effort. Cass Holloway ensuring the New York City water system is viable for the next 100 years. And Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett on strengthening the U.S. Navy's information dominance for the 21st century. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders can cut cost and improve performance. All of this and so much more in the Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Julie Parity, Administrator of the Food and Nutrition Service within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Also joining us today from IBM is Randy Livingston.
Julie, we talk with many of our guests about the use of collaboration and partnership among federal and state agencies, as well as with the private sector, to achieve mission results. How does FNS leverage partnerships to improve operations and outcomes? And how will these partnerships change over time?
Well, I don't know that there has ever been more support for collaboration among federal agencies than we have today. The opportunities are absolutely enormous. We've got some natural partners, for example, at HHS, at Department of Labor, even at Veterans Administration, Department of Education, and we've begun dialoguing with them. We're getting help from the Domestic Policy Council in that regard. The Secretary has done a number of events with other secretaries at other departments, and I don't recall ever seeing that level of collaboration before. Of course, the challenge is that we're all extraordinarily busy, and so, you know, to put collaboration into the mix of everything else that we're doing, just trying to run our day-to-day programs as well as all the new initiatives that are coming down because of the tremendous interest in our programs, and then adding collaboration to that is a real challenge. But nonetheless, we're very excited by the potential of it if we can just find a way to sort of develop those connections and develop those networks, make sure that staff is talking to one another as well as policy officials. I think it's really huge. I have thought from a number of years that there were more opportunities than we were availing ourselves of with partnering it with the private sector. Clearly, working with the grocery manufacturers, the food producers, farmers, the retail community, we've got some excellent relationships there. But my sense was that there was more that the private sector might want to do. And I'm thrilled that there has recently come together a corporate coalition to end hunger. It's being led by Walmart, but it's made up of a number of very significant private sector entities, including USA Today, who have come together and pledged significant funding as well as all of their efforts to work with us to end childhood hunger. So I think it's just another example of the support that these programs have across the country and the understanding that in the United States, there's really no place for families to be hungry and that we all have to pull together to do everything that we can at various levels, various sectors, to make sure that no family in this country goes hungry. So it's in a very exciting time. I think there's tremendous opportunity for us to do collaboration, and it certainly does bode well for these programs and for the American people.
Julie, I'd like to transition to the future. What are some of the major opportunities and challenges your organization will encounter in the future? And how do you envision your agency evolving to meet those challenges and seize those opportunities?
Well, it's interesting. You know, these programs have been around for a long time. FNS celebrated its 40th anniversary in the summer of 2009. And we think we do an extraordinary job. We've talked about the numbers of people that we help with these programs every single day, millions and millions and millions. So I don't know that dramatic changes to our programs are necessary. We have found over the course of, you know, the last several years that there's